This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, looking back at the year 2014. And we're going to begin by talking about politics, headlines that shook the nation. Ken Rudin, our political junkie, joins us as he does many Fridays. Ken, Happy New Year. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. I'm already nostalgic about 2014.
Are you really? Well,
not really.
Let's think about we could talk about anything. Why don't we just start with healthcare? And the reason, I guess, is because when last year began, 2014, it was in the headlines. It has drifted away, and that by itself should be a story.
Well, you know, when the year started, remember, the Democrats were really on the defensive. That's when they had the botched rollout of the healthcare.gov, the website. And, of course, this was the Obama administration's most signature achievement. And to have the web rollout come so poorly, it emboldened Republican critics, saying, you know, it's not that the administration is not ready for prime time. And it made a lot of Democrats embarrassed because this was supposed to be the achievement that they were going to run on in 2014 elections.
And they didn't. It was a pretty bad rollout, as you said. That makes headlines when you can't actually log on and do the thing. It got fixed, and it turns out there's every evidence that it's working pretty well. In fact, it's showing signs of bringing down health costs. People have got, in fact, insurance that didn't have it before. Some people are paying more. It's a little upsetting. But in many ways, it is looking like a successful program. A year later.
When you looked at the Democratic candidates running for election or re-election in 2014, many of them stayed away from it. They shied away from it. And the administration was saying, look, this is a proud achievement. We've put more and more millions of Americans with coverage than we've ever had before run on it. And yet the Democrats, who, like everybody else, can look at polls, and the polls still said that there are a lot of people who just felt that it's not perfect. There's still a lot of glitches, not so much in the website, but in the system itself, and things could be fixed. So rather than say things could be fixed, a lot of Democrats ran away from it, and it just fed into the Republican conversation that the healthcare is a losing issue for the Democrats, and that's seemingly what happened on November 4th.
Well, immigration was a topic last year and likely to be one this year, and it seems perhaps a thornier topic for the Republicans. Let's talk about that.
Here's the interesting thing. If you looked at the results of the 2012 elections, the message was Latinos are voting overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidates. Republicans are in big trouble. There are major demographic changes in this country. There's a system where 11 million people are undocumented people are here, and it's just not working. The Republicans know that the future is in these changing demographics, and yet, Speaker of the House John Boehner said over and over again, we're not going to pass something as monumental, but as also monstrosity. Mm-hmm. We're not going to pass something as gigantic as what the Senate did in 2013. We're going to do much more incremental. And so, of course, not only did the House not pass anything incremental, they passed nothing at all. And ultimately, though, they didn't pay a political price. If you looked at the Latino voting in November of 2014, it was certainly down from 2012. No Republicans seemed to pay the price because of their lack of action on immigration. Now, 2016 could be another story, but right now, if you looked at 2014, immigration did not happen, and Republicans did not pay a price for it.
All right. Well, President Obama's popularity took a big hit this year. I mean, the federal government in general, not very popular. The Republicans may inherit some of that now that they control Congress, but the president did seem to take the biggest hit. Why was that?
Well, you know, everything seemed to be a metaphor for what was wrong with the president. If you say, if you looked at the numbers about Obamacare, if you looked at the anger over the National Security Agency over surveillance tactics, if you looked at the scandals in the Veterans Affairs Administration, if you looked at the botched behavior by the Secret Service about the IRS, and you think of all these things, and it just comes down to Obama. And so all these things that are going wrong, a sense in the country that things were just not on the right track on all these different issues. And I'm just talking about domestic right now. I'm not even talking about foreign policy, where there seemed to be an inability of the United States to accomplish much around the world. And it basically just weighed on the president, just as all the things that weighed on the Republicans in 2006 and 2008. You blamed President Bush for it. Here you're blaming President Obama, and we saw that throughout the year, leading into the election.
Let's take a look at what precedents there might be for these coming 2 years. You've got the president in what is traditionally considered the legacy years of his presidency, right? The last 2 years, can't run again. Here's where presidents frequently focus on their legacy. And a hostile Congress as well. The Congress is in control of the Republicans. Well, what does that mean for the nation going forward? How does the president relate to Congress? Does he have to? What kind of a picture does this paint?
Well, that's a good question. We saw after the 2006 elections, when the Republicans really got hammered, a lot of people in the Republican Party ran away from President Bush. The last 2 years, they basically refused to acknowledge he existed. We did see at the end of 2014, when the Congress passed a spending bill, many Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, like Elizabeth Warren, they basically said President Obama and the administration is wrong on this, that they're just violating the democratic principles. And so you saw a lot of Democrats running away from the administration. What the president can do, I mean, there's a lot of, look, it's very unlikely that he's going to come to send any special deal with the Congress on immigration. So he has these executive powers that he says he will use, and he's threatened he would use, and he said all along that he would use it if the Congress didn't act. Well, then not only is the Congress not acting, but it's also getting very angry at the president, upset with the president, talking about these executive powers, the House of Representatives suing the president over his ability or his willingness or his indication that he's going to use his powers to make changes about immigration. But the president feels that, look, I've had 6 years. I'm not getting along with the Congress, and I'm not getting a lot of things are not getting done. And I have these 2 years left to cement, as you say, Frank, cement my legacy. And I'm going to do it, any way I can. If it means executive action, so be it.
Well, let's talk about local police accountability. Certainly that is in the headlines and not necessarily in the authority or in the scope of work of Congress or the president. But when we talk about Ferguson, when we talk about New York protests all over the country, what impact is this having at the national level?
This is a big issue, and of course, to say that it's it's been simmering in the African American and the poor communities for years is an understatement. We see more and more instances, and you mentioned Ferguson, you mentioned Staten Island. We've seen a Department of Justice report criticizing the police department in Cleveland, Ohio. There is a clear disconnect between the police department, local police departments, which is for the most part white, and you have many mixed communities, African-American communities, minority communities, where the relationship between the police and the folks in the neighborhood is just not working. So when you see more and more headlines of black unarmed people, youths, I mean, whether it's Michael Brown, whether it's Eric Garner, either being shot by white policemen or killed, in the case of Eric Garner with the chokehold on Staten Island, there is a feeling that something is not working. Now, what's interesting is that this, unlike everything else in the world, this does not seem to be splitting Democrats and Republicans. There are a lot of Republicans who just feel that either is a militarization of the police that is wrong, or the fact that too many black people feel that they are automatic targets walking while black, is what a lot of people say. You see a lot of Republicans saying this is not a way for the country to exist, and perhaps if there's anything going to get accomplished in the next 2 years, I don't know if there's a national conversation on race. I don't think laws could be passed, but something needs to be done for people to understand that there is a tremendous disconnect between the most crucial part of our government, the police department, and the citizens it's supposed to protect.
All right. And in terms of political action, policy matters, and big debates in the year ahead, what should we keep our eyes on, Ken?
Well, ultimately, everything seems to be directed towards an election. If we're looking at 2016, once again, you start talking about voting blocks. And once again, you're going to see people like Jeb Bush and others in the Republican Party saying the way to make the Republican Party relevant is to be relevant on immigration. So there's going to be tremendous pressure again on John Boehner, with a larger Republican majority than he had in the 113th Congress, to make some changes about immigration policy. Now, again, it may be incremental. It may be just small stuff. But again, you know, there are things that Congress has to do. It's one thing for the Republicans to be on the outside and carping and complaining and throwing grenades. But when you're in the majority of the House and Senate, no longer are you the party of opposition. You should be the party that has an agenda. And I think both incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker John Boehner know that they're going to have to present some kind of a program that to run on for the Republicans to run on. And so we may see it, if it may be on immigration, maybe on tax policy, you know, maybe on energy policy, talking about the pipeline, the Keystone pipeline, that Republicans are going to have to come up with some kind of an agenda so when the voters go to the polls again in 2016, there's a difference between the Democrats and Republicans.
All right, Ken, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Political junkie Ken Rudin. You can take a look at, connect to all of Ken's stuff at our website, stateofthings.org. Today, talking about the events that shaped 2014, looking ahead to 2015. Just ahead, we'll talk state politics and business news of the past year on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, looking back at the year 2014. And throughout the past year, we saw a lot happen in North Carolina politics. There was the Duke Energy coal ash spill, one of the most expensive Senate races in U.S. history, and discord in the state's General Assembly. WRAL Capital Bureau Chief Laura Leslie reported on all of that and more and joins us now for a look back. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Frank.
Well, let's talk about the legislature itself, controlled by the Republicans. They control the entire state, and yet there was a lot of friction this year.
Well, you know, I think they discovered what the Democrats learned a long time ago, which is when you have a really big majority, sometimes it can be hard to keep everybody, you know, together, corralled. And, you know, we had sort of this strange, we'll say triangular relationship between the Senate and the House and the governor, with the House mostly on the governor's side, and the Senate coming out pretty strongly against some of the things that the governor and the House were doing. And so there was quite a bit of friction, you know, and I think also that Senator-elect Tillis's run for this obviously right. didn't really help things, and he was sort of more vulnerable to delays and things like that. And, you know, and we definitely saw that happen as the session dragged on into August.
Maybe the best illustration of that was the fight over education and education spending. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. The question of teacher raises. You know, the two houses were kind of fighting over who was going to give bigger raises, where the money was going to come from, how much of the money could be found in other places of the budget. And this went on for a long time. It was a stalemate that went on for quite a while. They finally came to an agreement. You know, we heard a lot about 7% average raises. But when you actually factored in the longevity pay, which was taken away, it was less than that, more like 5.5%. And some teachers only got like a third of a percent, some of the senior teachers. And so it was, let's put it this way, I'm sure it made a good soundbite, but there were a lot of teachers who felt like it was not an accurate description of what they got out of it.
And spending on education overall is still lower than it was in 2007, so lower than pre-2008 levels.
Well, the problem is that, you know, spending on education isn't just a thing. It's also per capita, and we're growing. And so, you know, basically we have to add money, or the state is supposed to be adding money for each student that the districts say that they're expecting to have extra in the coming year. So the whole question about cutting spending versus not expanding it as much as necessary, I mean, that's really kind of getting into the weeds there. But, I mean, when you see stories like the one that we've seen about how schools are lacking toilet paper, schools are lacking copy paper, it's not hard to see that funding is definitely below what it was.
Medicaid spending as well. Not only spending, but also the decision not to expand Medicaid. I mean, that's one decision. But then other questions on Medicaid spending and Medicaid reform. All of that was supposed to happen, Medicaid reform this year.
That was the big story that didn't happen this year. And that was supposed to happen. It's a very, okay, you know, there's a lot of complicating factors here. One is that the HHS was dealing with a new billing system, NCTRAX, that did not perform really well out of the box. They've gotten it mostly straightened out. Another problem that they had was that their budget forecasting was really pretty dismal and missed the boat almost every year. They finally sort of got that fixed. So, you know, what they were trying to say initially was, let's wait on reform until we get the system sort of stable. You know, but in the meantime, you've got the Senate who wants to do really this pretty fast-tracked, including privatization perhaps, contracting out to for-profit HMOs to manage that program in different parts of the state. And the House and the governor on a very different track, saying this needs to be a slower process so we don't fall apart, you know, and that maybe it should be led by providers and affordable care organizations instead.
And some of that's going on already in the state. And, of course, the state argued that, look, under DHHS, we've actually gotten some of the stuff under control. So there's a good argument that the state can actually handle this with the mechanism in place. That debate goes forward into the next
year. Right. And I think we'll hear more about it because, you know, one of the things that we're facing is the revenues are below forecast. Mm-hmm. We knew revenues were going to be down anyway because of the tax cuts, but they're down below what they were supposed to be even with the tax cuts because the economy and job creation simply hasn't rebounded as quickly as they had forecast. So, you know, they're going to be looking for places to save money. And one of the arguments that the Senate has made is that doing it their way would save money faster in Medicaid by getting costs under control by shifting the risk to these outside groups. So I think this is a conversation we'll be hearing a lot more of this year.
One of the areas of contention in within the Republican Party in the legislature and in the governor's office had nothing to do with legislation. It had to do with the coal ash bill, the Duke coal ash bill. And there again, fractures appeared in the Republican among Republicans.
Right. And, you know, I mean, in all fairness, this was not the Republicans didn't create this problem.
Right.
This has been a problem for a long time, and the state has done nothing about it. But of course, this year they're kind of forced to do something about it when that spill happened in February at the Dan River. So the question is, what exactly should be done about it? And you know, the House wanted one thing, the Senate wanted another thing. There was a lot of chest thumping and press conferences about exactly how hard they were going to come down on all of this. But, you know, when you get right down to it, Duke's point, and I think it's valid, is they've got 100 million tons of coal ash. That's not going to go away overnight. And getting rid of it is not going to be a simple process. It's going to take some time. It's also going to be complicated by sometime in the next few days, we're expecting for the federal government to release its classification of coal ash. And part of the problem with that is that if they decide to classify it as a hazardous waste, it's going to make it more difficult for legislators to pursue one of the options they're looking at, which is trying to find beneficial uses, using it, for example, in construction and asphalt, even in drywall. And if it's classified as a hazardous waste, then that is going to basically put everything that they've been trying to do on hold while they sort of reconfigure what Duke is going to have to do to get these coal ash ponds closed up. But they are requiring them to close them down, not necessarily excavate them, but at least stop using them.
So if the Republicans didn't face much opposition within the walls of the Capitol, outside they got a lot. Moral Monday, much impact at all on the business of the state?
I think it's difficult to say exactly what kind of impact Moral Monday has had because I think some of it may have been preventive. Some of it may have, you know, resulted in conversations that none of us were privy to in back rooms. It certainly did seem to bother some lawmakers. And it certainly did get a lot of attention. And I think one thing we can argue that it did do is focus more public attention on what the legislature was doing. I mean, that's not always an easy sell in the summer. People are busy. They're on vacation. It's easy to just sort of ignore the legislature. But, you know, at least what the Moral Monday protest succeeded in was keeping the cameras down there, keeping people talking about it.
So you talked about the revenue shortfalls. I want to now start looking forward. One of the promises of this legislative agenda was that we're going to bring more business to the state by cutting taxes. Wealthy families will cut their taxes. Businesses, corporations, wealthy businesses will cut their taxes, and that will attract more business and revenues will go up. Didn't happen. Is it too soon to tell, or what's going to happen going forward now? Revenue shortfalls are pretty difficult to deal with.
Well, I'm sure the architects of that plan would simply say it hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. We're just waiting for it, and it's going to catch up any day now when things are going to get better. Looking nationally, the economy is improving. Our unemployment rate is still higher than the national average, but it is substantially lower than it was, although it depends on how you look at it and how big the labor force is actually smaller. We're just now catching up to where we were before the recession. The revenue shortfall could be a major problem, and the reason I think so is because we've been hearing in this interim period between sessions about all the things that are basically falling apart. And the state went through a lot of deep cuts in 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. They haven't been putting the money back in, and there are a lot of programs that are literally held together at this point with bubble gum and rubber bands. And one of them, for example, the Charlotte Observer recently had a really great story about the court system. I mean, we've got courts where you don't have a court reporter You know, another place to look, the state crime lab. We've got these huge backlogs. And part of the problem is that they're not paying the analysts enough to keep them. They get poached by everybody else because they're so underpaid. Ditto for the medical examiner system. Ditto for the mental health system in prisons. I mean, there are, I was telling a friend, it's kind of like, you know, when you have an old house and you don't do the maintenance, eventually something breaks down and it's going to cost you a lot of money to fix it. And they're kind of at that point, I think, now where things are really starting to show that they've been underfunded for several years and they're going to have to start fixing things soon or there are going to be some breakdowns.
Well, and again, getting back to the idea of job creation, also people don't want to move into that house. And education is another part of this. We talked about it earlier, but if you're not keeping pace with the states around you, that's one of the elements that makes you look less attractive if I'm house hunting.
Well, and I think we heard something about that this year. I think the Republicans, Democrats, of course, accuse them of simply adopting this line for an election year, pose. But I think that the point is sort of getting through to some of the Republican lawmakers that they really are losing some of their better teachers.
And the governor's race, we could say, has begun in earnest. 2 years from now, Governor McCrory will presumably run for re-election. What impact is that going to have on this legislative year, do you think?
Well, it could be interesting. We know he rolled out his campaign website very kind of quietly last month. I think we've seen him out more. We've seen him doing a lot of ribbon cuttings. We've seen him doing a lot of job announcements. I think that will continue. I think he's going to try to – I mean, he has tried to play a role in policymaking. He hasn't always gotten much reception from – especially from the Senate side. I think he – you know, the leadership in the House, Speaker-elect or Speaker-designee Tim Moore, who will almost certainly become Speaker in January, I think will have a similar working relationship with the governor as former Speaker Tom Tillis did. And so I don't expect sort of the triangulation to change very much. But I think we're going to see the governor trying to use the bully pulpit more and be out more and be more visible as somebody who is making things happen in government instead of sort of sitting back and watching the legislature.
Laura, always a pleasure. Happy New Year. Thank you so
much. Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
WRAL Capital Bureau Chief Laura Leslie helping us take a look back at the past year of North Carolina politics. We look at business news for 2014 now, and for that we turn to Jason DeBruin, who is with the Triangle Business Journal. Welcome back, Jason.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Biggest news, of course, GlaxoSmithKline, right?
Yeah, the unfortunate news this year was that Glaxo plans to lay off about 900 workers. Silver lining is that maybe some of those workers, as many as 400 or 450, will be able to find work with a contract research organization called ParXL. They're here in Durham, the details of that are unclear, and whether or not that'll actually happen, again, is also still sort of left to the unknown. That was a pretty big hit that the Triangle took. Certainly in the pharmaceutical industry, Glaxo has been a big name, and 900 jobs being lost is never good.
Right. And so another local pharmaceutical story was Salix Pharmaceuticals. Roller coaster year for them.
Big time roller coaster. They had a lot of different tangential points. Salix, as you know, of course, is the largest homegrown pharmaceutical company that we have here. So they're not the biggest, but they're the biggest one that had its roots here in the Triangle. They make a lot of gastrointestinal drugs. And at first, back in the spring and then summer, they started to go through a deal where they would have acquired a foreign-based company and then moved their headquarters overseas. You might have remembered over the summer this was called Inversion, and it got a lot of attention. Then, of course, the Obama administration made some rules where that was no longer as favorable from a tax perspective, and so they had to call that off. Well, when they first announced it, their stock went up. Then whenever the rules came out, stock came back down. Then separately, you might also remember that Allergan and Valeant were in talks for a possible takeover, and that got pretty hostile. Well, Salix got thrown in the mix because they were looked at as a possible way for Allergan to make itself big enough to where Valeant couldn't take it over. That made their stock rise even more. It kind of went through the roof at that point. And then all of a sudden, at the end of the third quarter, they came out with a report that they had third quarter losses, and more importantly, they had some issues with their inventory. And so their stock came crashing down. It lost like 35% overnight, and they've been reeling ever since. Now they're starting to come back a little bit, but certainly well below where they were earlier this summer.
I guess that raises questions about the sort of the core business stability and environment here in North Carolina. You heard us talk with Laura Leslie just a minute ago about tax incentives. We've lost some of those incentives, business incentives in general. Legislature not too forthcoming on those. The tax cuts didn't seem to bring in businesses in droves. Maybe we'll have to wait and see. But the question, I guess, is overall, the business environment in North Carolina, what does it look like going forward?
Well, I don't want to sound all doom and gloom. Certainly, we've had plenty of new companies that have come here. You know, MetLife to be is a good example of a major hiring spree that we've had not only in 2014, but we'll continue to have in 2015. So there certainly businesses have chosen to come here, and I don't know if that's because of the tax cuts or it's because we have a good business environment. I mean, it's always a combination of everything. I think at the end of the day, we do still have a strong business climate here. I mean, we have a lot of things going for us that we've had going for us for a while. That starts with the university, certainly, but trickles on down from there, where you have just a good standard of living. So people want to come here. And then that, of course, builds on itself. When you have a good standard of living, more people come here. They make better companies. Then those better companies want to hire better workers. Better workers want to come here. So it sort of builds on itself. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we still do have a strong business climate here. We've had a few hiccups, particularly here in the last quarter, 6 months of this year. But I think overall we still have a pretty strong business climate here in North Carolina and particularly in the Triangle.
Medical business, of course, one of the bigger ones in the state of North Carolina. Medicaid reform didn't happen this year. It was supposed to. Legislature couldn't figure out how they were going to do that. So we might see that in the year ahead. But it didn't happen. And I'm wondering how physicians and hospitals and others in that industry took the news.
Well, they didn't take it well. And for selfish reasons on the one hand, but certainly also for population health reasons on the other hand. I'll talk about the selfish reasons first. As you know, of course, there are very strict laws that hospitals are not allowed to turn anyone away. And so what happens is you have someone that doesn't have health insurance, maybe isn't on Medicaid. They come into the emergency room. They come seeking help after some sort of a catastrophe perhaps or a heart attack or a car accident or something like that. The hospital has to treat them, does treat them, and then discharges them. Whenever they're gone, if they don't have the money to pay and they don't have health insurance, the hospital has to write that off as charity care, as lost income. If we would have expanded Medicaid, there would have been a higher likelihood that people without insurance are at least on Medicaid, and then the hospitals would receive some kind of a payment, maybe not the full, but some kind of a payment to compensate them for when these people come in. Now, by not expanding Medicaid, there's fewer people that have the insurance, and so there's fewer opportunities for the hospitals to receive that income. What the governor has said and what the legislature has said is that we're not necessarily opposed to that aspect. We just don't like the Medicaid system as it currently exists, and we want to reform it. And that's – you heard that starting in late 2013, then, of course, got hot and heavy in 2014. The governor and DHHS Secretary Aldona Vosh, they put out a plan for reform that was largely supported by not only the hospitals but the medical society as well, and many doctors put their support behind this plan. It was a good one in that it shifted some of the responsibility to the healthcare providers themselves to provide better care to these Medicaid patients. It also shifted some of the responsibility on the patients themselves. You know, they would be held accountable for going to see the doctor on a regular basis, but it didn't shift all the responsibility to them. So this is an inherently difficult population to deal with. They're transient. They don't all the time take their medication in the most proper way. They don't go see the doctor on a regular basis. So the state still would have shouldered some of that responsibility or some of that risk, as they say in healthcare. The House liked it. The governor liked it. DHHS liked it. The Senate did not like this plan. The Senate wanted to shift more of the responsibility to some sort of a middle management type organization where they would take much larger percentage of the risk, but then also, potentially be rewarded for it. This was something that the healthcare providers did not like, but it was something that the Senate sort of dug their heels in, and it got down towards the end of the session. The House and the Senate could not agree, no matter how much the governor tried to convince the members of the Senate to agree to it. It did not happen. So that was a bit of a loss, at least in terms of, or at least from the perspective of the healthcare providers and the hospitals. But we do think that it'll come back up in 2015. Of course, it's a long session, so there's more time to hash things out. And ideally, we'll see something reformed. Now, the governor, in addition to that, has also said that if we do pass a reform plan, he's not opposed to an expansion. So it might be something where we see a reform of some kind pass, maybe even early, as early as January or February. I don't have any inside knowledge, but I'm just guessing here. And then at that point, they can look to expansion maybe towards the middle of the summer. And then by the time they leave For this long session, we'll have not only a comprehensive Medicaid reform plan, but also even potentially some sort of an expansion plan.
And as you said, the governor and the House didn't like the Senate plan, which shifted the risk to private for-profit companies, essentially. And part of the reason for that is that one of the ways that you can, and the hope is that these private companies will cut costs and keep your overall cost down. The fear is the way they cut costs is by not providing service. That's not a good way to provide to run a medical system, according to the governor and to the House, and so that was the objection.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's one of the concerns of the healthcare community as well. Not accusing necessarily anybody of any nefarious action, but the incentives in a plan like that just really aren't set up right, because essentially the government, the state government, would give some private entity, a for-profit entity, X amount of dollars. We'll call it, you know, $1,000, and if they in medical claims pay out fewer than $1,000, they keep the rest as profit. If they pay out more than $1,000, that's a hit on them. So their incentive is set up to pay out as few claims as possible. And of course, if someone comes in and needs, you know, $1,200 worth of legitimate care, it could potentially be in that middle organization's best interest to not provide that extra $200 of care. So that was the concern, certainly, of the healthcare community and certainly of people who are concerned, you know, from a population health standpoint about the people that are on Medicaid.
All right, Jason, always a pleasure. We will check in with you throughout the year. Happy New Year. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, and happy holidays.
Jason DeBruin reports for the Triangle Business Journal and helps us review the past year in the state of North Carolina. Just ahead, we'll take a look at some arts and culture headlines of 2014. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, continuing our look back at the year 2014. And next, pop culture, which at times has been headline news and certainly has had an influence on the news that made the headlines. The use of hashtags, for instance, helped spur demonstrations over the deaths of unarmed black men nationwide. The release of Beyoncé's album prompted conversations about what it means to be a feminist. And the allegations of rape by comedian and cultural icon Bill Cosby left us all wondering how we should feel about him and his art. Joining us to talk about these many diverse topics and other issues in pop culture this year, Duke professor and enthusiast, a pop culture enthusiast. I'm going to call you a pop culture enthusiast. Have you ever been called that before?
Yes.
Mark Anthony Neal and St. Augustine University Film and Interactive Media Chair Natalie Bullock Brown. Welcome back for both of you. We're doing great.
Thank you.
So we had you both on the show earlier this year to talk about Bill Cosby's 30th anniversary. We were talking about the art, the impact that Bill Cosby has had. And, of course, that was before all of the allegations came to light about allegations of sexual assault. So where are we now? How do we – well, you know, yeah. How do you feel about that? How do we feel about this?
So, first, it's not new. I think there are folks who have been aware of these charges for some time. I think the sudden focus on it really is a product of a new generation of folks and social media and the way information circulates very differently. And so I'm not surprised that it's gone down the way that it's gone down. But I also wonder at this stage what exactly the end game is for a 77-year-old man whose career, for all intents and purposes, is over. You know, what do we expect to exact from Mr. Cosby at this point in time? And, you know, and if we're serious about conversations about sexual violence and rape, you know, are we using Mr. Cosby's case as a springboard to seriously address these things in this country? Or is it just simply, you know, to go after Mr. Cosby, hoping that, you know, he can pay for what he needs, obviously, to pay for?
I agree. I also think that, well, to speak specifically to the idea of this conversation about rape and sexual assault and just how we regard it as a country, I think it's really interesting that these allegations come out at a time when we've had so much in, in the news cycles about football players and sexual assault, college campuses and sexual assault. And I think, you know, perhaps the universe is trying to get us to realize that, you know, we have not gotten this right yet. We still victim blame. We still question women who make allegations more than we believe them. And, you know, I just think, especially with someone like Bill Cosby, who, you know, from our conversation about the Cosby Show, we know
is so inextricably tied to his character, Cliff Huxtable, you know, it makes it very difficult, I think, for people in general to even fathom that this man could be responsible for what almost 30 women now are saying he has done. So I think I'm hoping that at the very least, because I know that there really isn't much that can be done about the things that he's done. And I just want to say I believe the women.
Absolutely.
But I think that, you know, if we can come out of 2014 having a better understanding about where we stand and realizing that we have not made sexual assault and domestic violence a priority in the manner that it should be, then, you know, none of this will be for naught.
How about social media? Is that helping or hurting in all of this? It certainly is. You know, we see hashtags, Black Lives Matter, in terms of consciousness. It's out there in all communities through social media. Is it a help or a hindrance or both?
If you think about gender violence and sexual violence as a form of trauma, I would not suggest anybody to work out their trauma in social media. And in fact, we see a whole lot of that. I mean, for many young folks, social media is the only outlet they have to discuss any of that. You know, so it's not surprising that we see all kinds of trauma replayed and restaged on social media in response, you know, to things like Bill Cosby and Adrian Peterson and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. I think where it's been helpful is that it has become a critical organizing tool. And everything that we've seen around I Can't Breathe hashtags and Black Lives Matter hashtags since August around Eric Garner, around Mike Brown, the boy in Cleveland, you know, it really speaks to the fact that this is the first social movement that this generation, however we want to define this generation, this is their social movement. And when we saw the marches in New York and Washington, D.C. recently, you know, no one's going to remember being in Washington, D.C. with Al Sharpton at that march. Everyone's going to remember being in Washington Square Park and seeing those overhead photos. And it embodied the shift that we're seeing in terms of social media strategies, social protest strategies, and a new generation kind of putting their signature on this moment.
Yeah. And I think I really appreciate what social media has to offer, you know, if you use it for good and not for evil. I mean, it does offer an opportunity. People can voice their opinion in ways that they may not be able to anywhere else and be heard and actually contribute to a conversation. And I have to say personally, I have definitely benefited from all of the articles and blog pieces that people post that inform me in ways that if I tried to depend on that information coming through, you know, regular media, there's no way.
Well, how many people are actually going to the video and seeing those videos because of their Twitter feed and not, you know, not any other way?
Yeah.
That's how they got there. That's how they saw it.
Right.
You know, I think of the story of someone like Lennon Lee Lacy, you know, his death, you know, in North Carolina. And it's something that was not carried by the national media until 3 months afterwards. And it really was folks doing blog posts and using social media to get the word out about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about music. That's also a matter of pop culture. Natalie, several bright spots throughout the year. One that stood out, of course, a giant topic of conversation, Beyoncé's self-titled album at the end of 2013. That was just a big event all by itself, and it turned out to be a hot topic as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just going to say, for the record, I was not a Beyoncé fan prior to this album. I just was not. And that's a whole other show. Why? But I just think she just came out swinging on so many levels with this album. Just from a business perspective, the fact that there was no promotion and she drops this thing and it, I mean, how many million, at least a million buy it in 24 hours. But then just what she seems to be asserting on the album, like, you know, we could talk about that for days, but the fact that that Beyoncé is clearly grappling with what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a feminist, to what extent should she be able to express herself in all the ways that she expresses herself, including sexually, in this public manner, and not be talked about in any other way than as a mother, as a wife, as a woman, as of respect, you know, respectability. You know, I think it's very interesting, and I believe that she has at least fueled a conversation that's very necessary about, you know, how women, black women in particular, are looked at and perceived based on how we kind of show up and are present in the culture.
When you think about Beyonce's last 18 months, you know, an inauguration, you know, Super Bowl, you know, 35 years ago, if we looked at her counterpart, which would be Diana Ross, if Diana Ross had made any of those kind of achievements back then, it'd be incredible, right? The fact that Beyonce gets pushback, you know, speaks to the fact that we're in a different kind of moment. But, you know, my moment for Beyonce this year that kind of speaks to her grownness, you know, whether or not you want to believe the tensions between she and her husband and the divorce were staged to sell concert tickets or not. But it was clear that, you know, in terms of public opinion, folks were siding with Beyonce against her husband. But she would post things on Instagram where she's wearing, you know, Jay-Z blue. And it's like, look, I'm wearing my Jay-Z blue. And it was such a grown woman move to me, because what she was saying is that regardless of what's going on in our relationship,
right,
you're not going to demonize this man because this man is the father of my child. And I was like, wow. That is an adult move, the kind of thing that we don't see on reality television and what have you.
Yeah.
And in her public life, very much aware of her position as someone who has a lot of eyeballs on her, and takes that platform and talks about some of the issues about what it means to be a woman in this particular culture. And I think Pretty Hurts probably is a pretty good artistic representation of that, right?
Mama said, you're a pretty girl, what's in your head? It doesn't matter, brush your hair, fix your teeth, what you wear is all that matters. Just another stage, pageant the pain away. This time I'm gonna take the crown without falling down, down, down. Pretty girl, shine the light on whatever's worth. Perfection is a disease of a nation. Pretty girl, pretty girl, shine the light on whatever's worth. You try to fix something, but you can't fix what you can't see. It's the soul that needs surgery.
Beyonce, Pretty Hurts. How important is that song?
It's actually one of my favorite songs on that album, because I think that, you know, she's doing a lot of heavy lifting in terms of kind of dissecting and deconstructing the male gaze and how women and how we look, you know, that it's a burden, and it's really, you know, one of the things that oppresses us, because, you know, all the other things that you want to matter don't. You know, it is more about, you know, how your hair looks and what color you are, you know, is your skin light or dark, and all these things that then diminish, you know, what's in here in our brains, the other multiple contributions that we're able to make. And I think it is extremely powerful coming from someone like Beyonce, who clearly is a beautiful woman, to be saying, you know, I know something about this oppression, and I'm pushing back against it. I'm resisting it.
And she doesn't have to. I mean, that's the thing. She doesn't have to do the political song. She's Beyonce. She's going to be a success, whatever. And so she didn't have to do that song, it seems to me.
Right.
Well, Mark, was 2014 the year we resurrected the F word, feminism, feminist?
I don't think it's been resurrected. I think it's always circulated there. I think 2014 is the year where folks wanted to take ownership of it. And they got pushback from young feminists who were saying to academic feminists, you know, we get to define this word the way that we want to. If we want to attach it to Beyonce, why doesn't Beyonce have the right to think out loud about what feminism can be for her. Why don't we have the right to think out loud and to critique positions that feminists from 30 years ago might have taken and taken in a different direction? I mean, one of the ways that that comes out is around issues of sexual pleasure and desire, right? That's something that's a marked difference for younger generations of feminists from the feminists that were writing, particularly, you know, white women feminists that were writing 30 years ago.
Let's talk about film. Mark Anthony Neal, cinema, films, 2014, and one film that stood out because it has received a Golden Globe nomination is the film Selma. Tell us more about that.
You know, Ava DuVernay, and we could go back to Middle of Nowhere, you know, the film that she released that did not get a wide studio, you know, release, but she figured out a way, you know, the whole tug movement of trying to bring movies to people. You know, she understands better than many generations of black filmmakers now that, you know, if you cannot get the studio support that you want, you have to build your own mechanism for having places where you can show the films. It's very 1930s black Chitlin circuit like, you know, for a social media generation. And the benefit is that now that folks can see that she can actually deliver a film and deliver an audience, well, we'll allow you now to do the studio film Selma, you know, and now, you know, Middle Nowhere is going to come out on DVD, and that's as important, you know, as a release of Selma, you know, to a wide audience in January.
Absolutely, and I'm just so inspired, I have to say, by Ava DuVernay because Middle of Nowhere. I mean, she deserves, you know, let's just put it out there. She deserves to be able to direct a Hollywood film like Selma and be backed by people like Oprah Winfrey because she is good. Right. I mean, she is excellent. Right. You know, she's not just being given a chance because she's a black female. She showed through Middle of Nowhere and I dare say the first film that she came out with, the name of which is escaping me, but Middle of Nowhere was, I mean, that's one of, I think it's one of the best films of 2014, actually, because the writing, the acting, I mean, it just hits on all sorts of levels. And, you know, what Mark talked about in terms of her ability to figure out how to distribute that film and then also make a way for other black films to be distributed and seen is so important. And, you know, she really is following in the path of our early pioneers like Oscar Michaud, you know, and I think she has brought that ingenuity and that innovation, you know, to this present time in a way that, you know, has to be taken notice of. And certainly I think people in Hollywood, you know, they get it. They see what she's capable of. And I think it's wonderful.
All right. How about television? What should we be binging on from 2014 and look forward to in the year ahead?
I only have time to watch two shows on a regular basis. I mean, besides Shondaland on Thursday night, but for me, it's Parenthood and particularly Nashville. Nashville, and particularly the character Deacon Claiborne, you know, which may be one of the most well-written characters that we've seen on network television in some time. And, you know, it's a better reality television show about the music industry than any of the reality television shows about the music industry.
I think that we just cannot leave 2014 without talking about Shonda Rhimes. I mean, she has clearly established herself as a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, between Scandal and Grey's Anatomy and How to Get Away with Murder,
right,
which she executive produces. I mean, she's here to stay, and she is absolutely making an impact on how black female characters are not only, I guess, received, but also written. You know, she's just doing, I think, a lot of work that even remains to be seen how important her presence now is going to be, you know, historically.
It was a long year. We only gave you 17 and a half minutes to sum it up, and you've done a great job. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Mark Anthony Neal from Duke University and St. Augustine University Film and Interactive Media Chair, Natalie Bullock Brown. Thanks for being on the program. And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.